Acts chapter 4. Like I just mentioned, we are working through the book of Acts, looking at really two pieces. The first piece is, how do you and I grow as a disciple of Jesus? And we've been saying this over the last couple of weeks, that a disciple of Jesus is simply a person who has surrendered their life to Christ. And a lot of us don't really get that, or we don't view ourselves as a disciple. Yeah, I'm a Christian. I've surrendered my life to Christ. But disciples, man, that's like the varsity squad. I'm not there. The problem is the Bible. The Bible makes it really clear that anybody who has given their life to Jesus, now you're a Christian, you are a disciple of Jesus. But also, what we see in the book of Acts and throughout the scriptures is this. Disciples of Jesus grow personally in their walk with Christ, but also grow in making other disciples. They grow in making other disciples. In the scriptures, you can't have one without the other. And for some of you in the room, I have love and marriage going through my head, big time generational gap in this room right now. Some of you get that, the minority. But as a disciple, and as you grow as a disciple, you're called to grow in making more and more disciples. All of us are on mission where we live, work, and play. That's very biblical. And what we see in this passage today in Acts chapter 4 is a great example of people who are growing as disciples in a very specific area. But what it does, it leads them to making disciples at the same time. Now, what is that area that they grow in? I don't want to give it away yet, because we have some path that we need to trail, or a trail that we have to blaze, if I can say that right, to get to this point of understanding how profound the change was in these believers and how God worked in their hearts in such a way that he actually changes them to something. And that something is profound, it's beautiful, it's deep, and we want it. I think all of us will want it. So let's dig into this passage and start working our way down the path, and we will see exactly what it was that God changes them into. If you go back to verse 31, it's the verse right on top of the section Justin read, and we get some great context into what really is taking place here. Verse 31, chapter 4, and when they had prayed, so now you have the believers in Jerusalem, they're gathering together. And I've said this before, I'll say it again. We have to get out of this Tyler buckle the Bible belt mindset that, oh, the believers were going to Grace Community Church of Jerusalem. Yeah, our First Baptist of Jerusalem, our First Methodist of Jerusalem. There was none of that. If you were a follower of Christ in these days in Jerusalem, you were simply huddling up together, gathering together with other believers. And that's exactly what's taking place here. They're joining together, and what are they doing? They're praying. Simply praying. And the place in which they were gathered together was shaken. And they were filled with the Holy Spirit. They continued to speak the word of God with boldness. Now this is really intriguing, because these early believers, these disciples of Jesus, are gathering up together, they're simply praying together, and then God begins to move within them in a powerful way, even to the point, it says, that the place they are meeting was what? It was shaken. Now that absolutely is a biblical theme, that anytime the presence of God moves in a powerful way, the object in which it moves in is shaken. I mean, if you go back to Isaiah chapter 64, Isaiah says when the presence of God comes down from heaven and onto this earth, not only are people shaken, he says, but even mountains are shaken. I mean, if you haven't noticed, when you read your Bible, that when God moves in the life of somebody, he begins to stir in the life of somebody, he's not really all that tame, is he? He's actually pretty ferocious and begins to deconstruct our lives, pick apart our life, but then to reconstruct it into something much better, much more glorious, much more beautiful, much more deep and profound. So what you have here is these people, early believers, encountering God, and he's shaking within them. You know what you don't have in this passage? It's a group of people coming together on church on Sunday and walking away saying, yeah, you know what, man, my goal this week is I need to be a better Christian this week. You don't have that. You have real people encountering an unbelievable God. And that unbelievable God begins to move in them. And look at what it produces, though. Down in verse 32, as God moves within them, it says, no one that said that any of the things that they or that belonged to them was their own. Verse 34, God moves in them, and the response is, there was not a needy person among them. So what is God doing? He's stirring within these men and women in their response, and the only way they know how to respond now is to say, God, here's my life. Here are my resources, my abilities, all that I have. Like, here it is. Take it. I take it. And apparently he continued to move in the lives of early believers to such a degree that Julian, who is the last non-Christian Roman emperor, who despised Christianity, by the way, despised it, wrote a letter to a friend of his, and this is more of a modern paraphrase of what he said in that letter, but this is what he said. As God was moving in the lives of these people, and they were responding with just open-handedness, he says, the Christian's success lies in their charity to all. And he goes on to say to his friend, they take care not only of their poor, but ours as well. And God quakes within them, and they respond with saying, God, here's my life. I recognize there are several of you who grew up as like the good Christian church kid. You came out of the womb praising Jesus, singing Tomlin songs, and you're like, which did not happen, right? But you did. You grew up in church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night. You tried to follow the rules. That is such a good thing. It is. But my question for you as the kid who grew up in the Christian home, which I love that testimony. It is a good testimony. It is. But my question is, has your faith become your own, or is it still your parents' faith? Like, have you encountered God to such a degree where he is quaking your life? Like rattling your life right now. And you're seeing in your life a response of complete surrender to him and saying, here's my life, Jesus, here's my life. Or maybe you were not the good Christian kid growing up. You did not follow all the rules. But you have been just caught in this cycle of sin. And you come to church on Sunday and you say, you know what? I'm going to clean my life up this week. I'm going to stay away from the wrong people. That's a good thing, okay? I guess. But you find yourself on Thursday night in that same cycle of sin. And you come back in here Sunday, you feel really guilty, you feel condemned, and then you go back, I'm not going to do this anymore, and then you're right back into that. And Jesus is saying, no, but I want to transform you. I want to change you. You can't do this on your own. Or maybe some of you come in today and you have this nice little comfortable Christian life. You don't really welcome challenges to your faith. You're fine. Like, I'm okay being in my little box. I control my box. I control my life. And Jesus is saying, I want to explode your little box because I want to change you into something much more deep, profound, beautiful, and glorious. That's what he's doing here with these believers. He's quaking within them, and he's changing them into something. Here's why. Here's the reason why. Because God is not satisfied with our relationship to him being a matter of information. His desire is our heart and life transformation. When you think about your relationship with God, do you understand? He's not satisfied with you just having a knowledge that he exists, a general belief in him. He is saying, I want to transform your heart and I want to transform your entire life. I want it all. I want it all. I don't want you just simply to know some Bible verses about me. I don't want you to have some general information about me. I want to change you. I want to change you. So what exactly was he changing them into? That's the question in Acts chapter 4. What is God quaking in them to change them into something? What is that something? What is it? But we have a case study at the end of the chapter here. It's a guy named Barnabas. Look down in verse 36. Did you notice a little something about Barnabas? It says this. For some reason, Dr. Luke, who wrote the book of Acts, decided to highlight just one of the many Christians that God was working in. And he highlights a guy named Barnabas. It says this in verse 36. Thus Joseph, who was also called by the apostles Barnabas, which means son of encouragement. Anytime you see a name change in the scriptures, it always signifies a life change. Saul goes to Paul. Abram goes to Abraham. Name changes are significant in the Bible. And now we have Joseph, which Joe probably looked on a name tag much more simplistic and easy and good than Barnabas, right? But for some reason, they changed his name from Joseph to Barnabas. Because what did Barnabas mean? It's a son of encouragement. I don't know if he was an angry man prior to knowing Jesus, but something takes place in this guy's life to where he's known as an encourager. I'm sure all of us in this room this morning would love to grow in encouragement and be known as an encourager. Jesus grabs this guy's heart. And now they know him as, man, that guy's an encourager. But also something else changes with him. It says that he was a Levite, a native of Cyprus. He sold a field that belonged to him, and he brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. Now, it's interesting because as a good Jewish man, and particularly as a Levite, he would not have possession of a field. For some reason, Joseph, now known as Barnabas, does. But what does he do with that? It's a possession that he has, and he brings it to the apostles and says, go build the kingdom. Here it is. God worked within him to such a degree that he says, man, my identity has changed, my temperament has changed, and even my possessions are changed. So what did Barnabas get? What did the disciples get? What were they changed to? Here's the point. God works in their heart to such a level that he pushes self out of them. And they have a light bulb moment to where they realize their life is about whole life generosity. Did you notice in this whole scene here how generous they are? But they got it. When they got Jesus and he began to work in them, all of a sudden it freed them now to say, here it is, Lord, everything, whole life generosity. What exactly is whole life generosity? Here it is for you. They understood that whole life generosity is sacrificially giving out of your best. Not your margins. Not a certain level to which you feel like, okay, I don't feel guilty because I gave this much. But actually giving out of your best from the depths of your resources and abilities. Whole life generosity is saying, God, you own it all. I was bought with a price. I'm no longer my own. Take my life. Here it is. Take it. Take my best. Take my best. Take the best of my resources, Lord. Take the best of my abilities. Take the best. It's yours. It's yours, God. It's whole life generosity. So here's a question I believe that we have to ask ourselves this morning. You have to ask yourself. I have to ask myself as well. Do you see? Do I see? Do you see yourself in this passage? Like, do you see yourself in Acts chapter 4 this morning? Do I see myself in Acts chapter 4 as being a part of this group and being about whole life generosity? Do you see yourself here? Because if I'm guessing, I'm probably going to guess that most of you are like me, that this passage produces not encouragement, but internal conflict. Why? Because oftentimes I don't see myself through the lens of whole life generosity. I don't. I respond oftentimes with, I hear this, and yeah, but, fill in the blank. And then I begin wrestling through and justifying through and trying to explain through why I'm not whole life generous. Why, when God moves in my heart, I don't respond like these men and women did with whole life generosity. Like, hey, I have this internal conflict. And again, if I'm guessing right, I'm guessing that probably the majority of us in this room that we hear this, but it produces this internal conflict and wrestling through, yeah, but I don't know. I'm not there yet. I don't feel like I'm there yet. Man, that's for the people who are really, really spiritually mature. I'm just not there yet. But there's a reality that God called these men and women to whole life generosity, and he absolutely calls you and I 2,000 years later to the exact same thing. To give our best out of the depths of our resources and abilities and saying, God, it's all yours. It's all yours. So I want to give you two reasons this morning of why we wrestle with this, why we struggle with viewing our life and living our life out through whole life generosity. Let me give you two. There's a lot of reasons, but I want to give you two, I think, main ones this morning. Why do we struggle with this? Why do we not see evidence of whole life generosity in our life? And again, this goes for the most mature of Christians in this room to an infant Christian. An infant. I think whole life generosity, we struggle with it when we live our life for self-glorification. I think we struggle with whole life generosity when our lives are wrapped up in self-glorification. And I would argue that we as American Christians in 2017 struggle with this maybe more than anybody on the planet. Maybe. Here's why. Because we live in a culture, and I think this is actually a pretty good thing, we live in a culture that places a premium upon individual rights. We love, and there's so much good that has come from placing a premium and making individual rights something that we in our culture value. Very, again, hear me out. There's so many good things. But in that, what can come at times, because we also live in a capitalistic culture, which there's pros and cons of that. Please do not email me tomorrow giving your 7 points why capitalism is great or why you think it's not great. You send it to idontcare@gcc.org. It's a great email address. I've been wanting to use that one for a long time. 9:30 service missed out today. Didn't use that one. But when you take individual, we value individual, and we value I'm the consumer, you have a product that meets my need, equates oftentimes to the world is about me. So we operate in the mindset, although we would deny it, we operate in a mindset that all 7.2 billion people in this world revolve around me. All 320 million Americans revolve around me. All 100,000 Tylerites revolve around me. So for the next 364 days of the year, it's about me. For the next 12 months, it revolves around me. For the next, 52 weeks, it will revolve around me. For the next 7 days, the week in front of me right now will revolve around me. The 24 hours that I live in today will revolve around me. And the next 60 seconds of this minute that I am standing in right now and existing in will be about me. The problem is that kills whole life generosity. And it feeds this hunger of self-glorification. It's about me. Here's what it will lead us to. It will lead us to this point then of really operating in and being motivated by this. When we are motivated by self-interest, self-indulgence, and a false sense of self-sufficiency, we will leverage all that we have for the purpose of self-glorification. Did you notice the theme in that statement? Self, self, self. Me, me, me. All of it. One of the most challenging stories in the scriptures comes in Acts chapter 2, or second, excuse me, not Acts chapter 2, sorry, 2 Kings chapter 2. And it's the story of a guy that I have a little bit of a man crush on. His name's Elijah. Okay, love the guy, even the point we named our firstborn son. I'm going through some counseling on that right now, but working it out, all right? But he challenges me in this. Elijah is one of three people in the scriptures who did not physically die on this earth. Jesus, the ace of spades, he's in the three. A guy in the Old Testament named Enoch also did not physically die. And the third guy is Elijah. Now, we make kids' curriculums around this. We make felt board Christianity around this, cartoons around it. He gets sucked up in a whirlwind, right? The chariot going into heaven, that's great. But have you read the chapter that takes place in the moments before he is taken to heaven is absolutely profound, yet often forgotten. Here's why. He starts his day out, and God has already told him that at the end of the day, I'm taking you to heaven. End of the day, you're done here on this earth. If that was you, if God told you in this moment right now that at the end of the day, your time on the earth, on this earth is done, just think about the weight of that moment. How would that change you today? If you thought, and most of us live as if we were never dying, right? We do. So we feel like we have this eternal moment of time here on this earth. But what if God said, today, at the end of the day, you're gone, and all of a sudden that window went from here to, I have 24 hours. Like, what would you do with your time? Would you go skydiving or Rocky Mountain climbing or 2.7 seconds on a bull named Fu Manchu? Somebody should totally write a song about that, all right? That one's free. Would you do something adventurous? Some of you guys are like, Google, like, what is, oh, Tim McGraw, that's pretty amazing. 15 years ago. Wow, how did I miss that one? Or would you, I don't know how to get back on the track now, right? Or would you go spend time with family? Would you pick up your phone? Would you call somebody that you know you have existing conflict with? And simply say, I'm sorry. You know what Elijah does? He doesn't spend the day on himself. And he gets down to the last moment. I mean, the last few seconds. And this is what he does. He looks at a guy named Elisha. I know the names are a little bit similar. Elijah looks at Elisha. Who is Elisha? He's the next prophet of Israel, which Elijah was that. He's the next generation. So what does this man do? Elijah looks at Elisha, and he says these words, what can I do for you before I'm gone? Of all the things, I mean, that challenges me, of all the things this man could have done, his last moment on earth, of all the times he probably could have justified, you know what, I've made my life all about other people, I'm doing something for me. He doesn't. He actually has the audacity to die to self and to look at another guy and say, hey, I'm about to go. See that chariot? It's waiting for me, man. It's going to be sweet. Before I go, what can I do for you? How can I serve you? That is a great biblical example of dying to self and self-glorification, where the man just goes, my time on this earth is not even my time. It's God's time. So God, how do you want me to use it? Hey man, what can I do for you before I'm gone? We see that in 2 Kings chapter 2 in the Old Testament with Elijah, and I think we see it living out in Acts chapter 4 with these believers. Young believers, by the way. And their time with Jesus has not been that long. And what happens? They start to look around and say, you know what, our possessions, our abilities, it's not about us. I'm giving out of our best. Like, here it is. Here it is. And I'm serving. I think they got something that we don't get. And when we start to live for self-glorification over time, it dissolves and fizzles out whole life generosity. Because life's not about being open-handed with all we have. Life becomes about how can everything serve me? Me. I think that's one of the reasons we struggle when we hear whole life generosity. I want to give you one more. I think here's another reason why we struggle with it. I think we struggle when we choose enslavement over contentment. I think we fail to grow in whole life generosity when we choose enslavement over contentment. And when you look at this passage in Acts chapter 4, this whole scene, you know what you don't have? You don't have enslavement. But you actually have a lot of freedom. You have men and women who are operating in freedom, not enslavement. I love this because the author of Hebrews chapter 13, gives us great insight into how over time we can fizzle out from whole life generosity and we can fall straight into something I don't think we understand that we're there, and it's called enslavement. Look at what the author of Hebrews said about this. He says this. He says, Hebrews 13, 5, keep your life free from the love of money. Now, please note, he says from the love of money. He doesn't say from money. He says from the love of money. But what does he call us into? And be content with what you have. So you see what he's talking about. Enslavement is living a life for the love of money. You're controlled by it. You're enslaved to it. And like I said, oftentimes I don't think we understand how enslaved we can be to it. He says, but there's something more freeing, something better. He says it's contentment. But here's what I love about the method in which the author of Hebrews takes. He doesn't give us a command and say, don't love money, be content, get over it, shut up. He doesn't do that. He actually leads us to a gospel implication. He says this, For he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. So he leads us to the source in which we can find complete contentment. And it's found in Jesus. And Jesus has promised that I'm never going anywhere. Even when you take one step forward and two steps back, you take many steps back. I'm not going anywhere. I've made a covenant with you. A commitment. I'm here. And you can find your complete rest and contentment in me. But here's the problem I think that we have. The culture that you and I live in, that we operate in, I mean, is mad. It's actually crazy when you step back and kind of look at it. Because culture is always telling us, you need this. Fill in the blank. To be happy and content in life. Your life will be something if you get a new car. Hey, getting a new car is awesome. The smell is great until it wears off, right? But when you believe that that new car will offer you true happiness and joy, then we got a problem. We have a problem. Or we believe like I did when I was a kid. If I can just get these shoes, if I get these Jordans, then kids around me will think, man, I'm awesome. Parents never bought me a pair of Jordans. Still wrestling through those issues right now, okay? But I truly believe that as a junior hire, that if I can just get these shoes, then I am cool. I am somebody by what's on my feet. But you growing up junior hires known as adults, we still do the same thing. If I can get into this house, then things are finally going to change for us and our family. Man, that house is great. But that house will not provide you true joy. It won't. If we can just get to this bank account number, then it won't. If I can just get out of this job, which I absolutely hate, and I get into this job, then things are finally going to change. Good jobs, career, that's fine, that's great. That job will not bring you to total contentment? Or what about this one? If we can just add one more kid to our litter, then our family is complete and our life will be as it was, or as it should be. And adding another kid to the litter is awesome. You can actually have a reality show on TLC and make a lot of money, probably. But I will say this, that won't bring you to complete contentment. It won't. And I think the author of Hebrews is saying it to his group that he's writing it to, and he's saying it to us today. When did Jesus stop being enough for us? Think about that. In your life, when did Jesus stop being enough? I mean, has Jesus ever come to this point where he has poured out infinite love and said, oh, you know what? Actually, it probably isn't infinite. It ran out. So you better get into that relationship and then you will finally be happy. Or when did he stop being enough to the point where we have to wear these clothes to be happy? When did he stop being enough to where we feel like we need security in life, and so this job, this bank account, this 401k, that will make me happy and secure? And he's saying, I've offered you ultimate security. I just said it. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Like, when did he stop being enough to find true joy and contentment in? Again, a new house is not a bad thing. A new car, it's not a bad thing. Getting into that new job, it's not a bad thing at all. God may be opening doors for you, but when we look to those things to find true joy, true contentment, it becomes a bad thing. Because Jesus all along is saying, man, I'm enough. I'm enough. And when did I stop being enough for you? And the answer is never. But we can get caught up in the madness of the culture we live in and truly believing, if I can just get that thing, then I will be content. And no phone, no job, no relationship, no pair of shoes has ever provided for you what Jesus infinitely can and does. It's not possible. But when we believe that he's not enough and we become enslaved, then all of a sudden whole life generosity dissolves into a mist. So you may be saying this morning, and I'll close with this, well, I think Acts chapter 4 is just kind of an isolated event in the Bible, right? But when you start reading this, you start seeing that when God does something powerful in the life of a human being, ordinary people, none of them had seminary degrees, by the way. None of them had been to a Beth Moore Bible study. I know, it's shocking, isn't it? None of them had read or quoted C.S. Lewis yet. Yet he quakes and moves in each one of them, transforming them and seeing them respond with generosity with their life, whole life generosity. One of my favorites is a guy, and he has like three verses dedicated to him. His name's Onesiphorus. I mean, can you imagine that on a name tag? It makes Luffle Halls look like nothing. But he has a couple of verses dedicated to him. In 2 Timothy chapter 1, Paul apparently had a friendship with Onesiphorus. And we see that Onesiphorus travels from his home to Rome where Paul's at. And Paul said that his friend Onesiphorus walked around Rome for days trying to find Paul. Why? Solely to encourage him. Wow. So he was generous with what? His friendship. Whole life generosity through being generous with his friendship. Or take a guy like Joseph of Arimathea. What I love about this man, the man was wealthy. He was pretty loaded. But what does Joseph do? He goes to Pilate and asks if he can take Jesus' body from the cross and bury it. With what? John says with 75 pounds of myrrh and aloe. Man, Bath and Body Works is like, that's impressive. Not that I've ever been there, of course. But he buries Jesus in a very specific way. And what was that? There's only one person in the first century that deserved a burial like that. It's called a king. A king. And this man is generous with his resources as he buries his king. Unapologetically. It actually says about Joseph, he was a secret disciple of Jesus to that point. And then he comes out and says, this is, Jesus is enough. My money, 75 pounds, a myrrh and aloe, nothing. Take it, Jesus. And he buries his king. What about John? John, who wrote the Gospel of John. Church history tells us that the remaining disciples, the ones that we've been reading about for a couple weeks here, actually, all will be martyred for their faith, with the exception of one. John was martyred for his faith. All the others died. John's the one who lives. He didn't get out easy because church history tells us that he was actually, while he was alive, put in boiling hot water because of his faith in the gospel. But he gets in old age to the end of his life, and we find that John is actually living and gathering with the believers in Ephesus. We have Ephesians written from Paul to the church in Ephesus. John couldn't walk in his old age, so church history tells us that they would actually literally pick him up, walk him up to the front of the gathering. They'd put him down front, and he would just simply speak wisdom to the church of Ephesus. I mean, would you want to be a part of that church? I love our church, but I mean, I'm leaving you guys for the church of Ephesus. Paul planted the church. Timothy's the pastor. John is an elder. That's amazing. And he just poured out through a generous way his wisdom. His wisdom. Whole life generosity. It could be more than money. It could be just pouring out your wisdom. Or what about Martha? Generous through her service. Or what about Paul? Here's the final one. I love this. What about Paul? Paul shares with the Thessalonians, the believers in Thessalonica. He says this, 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. That we were eager, I was eager not only to share the gospel with you, but my whole life as well. How is he generous? Sharing his life. These men and women as well, in Acts chapter 4, they got something that we struggle with. Nothing you and I have belongs to us. It all belongs to Jesus, because whole life generosity is the essence of growing as a disciple and making disciples.